Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill here.
And finally, I get to go on a little holiday.
And I've got, believe me, I've got Biltmore envy.
Do you? You've been there before, though, haven't you?
Several times.
Okay, so this was my first time. And of course, I had to bring everybody along with me. But yeah, we get a tour of the gardens at the Biltmore Estate. Their horticulturist there talks to me for a while, and you will get to enjoy it. It is a fabulous, famed, humongous chateau.
Oh, yeah. It's Asheville's a great place anyway.
Asheville's a cool city,
and
yeah.
It's a testimony to a whole lot of money, too. I mean, the Vanderbilts built their own railroad line.
I know.
To create that mansion.
There's so many cool little stories surrounding the place.
Put the garden around it.
Particularly
at Christmas time.
Yeah.
It really puts on the dog, so to speak.
They do.
It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous place. And you get to go, and I'm sitting here.
No, you'll get to go again.
Are you taking your chickens?
No, they're staying. They stayed home.
Oh, no. You need a chicken sitter?
They had to. My sister checked in on the chickens.
Okay.
As long as she doesn't bring a dog, Billy, it's all right.
You better bring him back presents.
So, absolutely. Another interesting sort of connection to Louisville is, you may not know this, but Frederick Law Olmsted designed, you know, was pretty much the last in his career, but he designed the gardens at Biltmore as well.
I did not know that.
Oh, really? Yeah.
No.
Yeah, so he designed our park system here as Central Park in New York, so pretty cool. So we do hope that you'll stay with us. That's coming up in the second part of Homegrown. Before that, we're going to talk to you. Bob's been wanting to do this for a while, just sort of fascinated with the folks that take care of all those really big plants that you see in the lobbies of hotels and businesses and things like that. And Craig Lustig's going to join us today in the studio. He's the owner and operator of Anything Grows.
G-R-O-E-S, for which he's very apologetic, but apparently came with the company.
when he bought it.
He can't do anything about it.
But yeah, they take care of interior landscapes. So.
Yeah, and some houses also, too. Mm-hmm. But, if he'll answer some questions also beyond that about the bigger trees in our houses and how to take care of the ficus trees. And we've mentioned palms before, but pay attention because you can learn things about how to take
care of
your...
There's got to be some tricks of the trade.
Yeah, some carryover to the homeowner and what they can do to their plants, decorating and so forth. And he's a very interesting guy, so it'll be fun.
Yes, so that's coming up today on Homegrown. We hope that you will stay with us. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Nothing.
Nothing? Aww.
And I'm happy.
Okay.
I'm on strike.
A little rest.
I was looking out the window a couple of days this week, and it was that gray 30 awful stuff, and there's things out there that need doing, and I said, I ain't doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take a week off and just look out the window, and I'm plenty busy anyway.
Yeah.
But I just said I'm not going to do nothing.
Yeah.
And I did that pretty well.
Well, and like that's the thing. Wait until you have those pretty days and that inspiration where you can get out and get some stuff done. But you don't have to work every day in the garden.
That's part of gardening too, really, is stop and smell the fermenting leaves or whatever is out there. So that's it. I'm doing nothing, kid. How about you?
All right. Well, kind of along the lines of, like, I'm not doing nothing, but, like, there's not really that much going on. But there is, because you look out the window, and it hit me particularly on that stretch of cold weather and very gray days.
Yeah.
Certain views out the window, and there's the crab apples.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with the red berries against the gray sky, and then... Who likes to sit in the crab apples and enjoy a little meal or hang out? The cardinals, the Papa cardinals, so the bright red. You know what I mean? So you see these little pockets of brightness that really do make a difference in that winter mood, especially on those gray days. And I have to say, this is the time of the year, because you don't have a love-hate relationship with crab apples because they water sprout and sucker so badly. When they bloom like they bloomed this spring, I'm in love with them. And all those berries on them right now, I'm in love with them again.
Yeah, I got one called Ralph Shea that's almost got golf ball size, bright red crab apples. And you're right. It's when the sun's setting behind it or you go out in the morning. Eventually, they'll turn kind of brownish as the season wears on. But, boy, they're right now. They're
usually the birds can clean them up pretty well.
Yeah, and that's good.
And the deer usually graze off the fallen ones beneath the crab apples at night. So, you know, there's a little love-hate relationship there as well. But if they can stick to cleaning up the floor, the ground underneath the trees, then that's okay by me. One other thing, too, Bob, the Nandina. This time of the year, I love the Nandina and the brightest, clearest red berries, the big panicles of red berries.
Yeah.
And, of course, the foliage is mostly evergreen, bamboo-like, a fabulous winter interest plant.
Yeah, that's one we sell at Hidden Hill a lot. And it's kind of a tough sell sometimes in the summer and the fall because people don't appreciate it. It's kind of nice, and it's got this shiny green leaf. But winter and fall and winter is when it does its thing, and it'll be red all winter. You're right. So it's a great plant for...
Because it's not like this knockout shrub just on its own.
No.
But those berries really steal the show this time of year.
It really is a 12-month plant.
Yeah, and it's a tough plant, too.
You betcha.
Pretty adaptable. So,
Nandina.
Yes. Nandina. And if you want to go check out other... interesting plants and berries, you can head out to Bernheim. They've got a couple of programs coming up in January. One is the Eco Kids series, Every Child Outside, Eco Kids. First Saturday, Nature Discovery Days. So Saturday, January 3rd, Stars of the Winter Garden Discovery Adventure. So give Bernheim a call or go to their website or our website at wfpl.org and you can get some more information on that. But basically, anytime between 1 and 4 on January 3rd for the activities for Eco Kids, Every Child Outside. I like that concept.
I do, too.
Well, from out enjoying the outside to maybe enjoying the inside a little bit.
Precisely.
With not necessarily all colossal plants, but, you know, what kind of plants do well in that interior landscape? And somebody who's been working on that for, gosh, over a decade now is Craig Lutzig. He's in the studio with us. He's owned and operated Anything Grows since 1999. They specialize in taking care of all those big container plants you see in the lobbies of big companies and hotels. Craig is a certified interior landscape professional, a board member of the Louisville chapter of the International Facility Management Association, and an active member of Greater Louisville, Inc., also a founding member of the National Interiorscape Network and Green Plants for Green Buildings. Craig, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So it sounds like from reading your bio earlier, you had a bit of a career change when you came to Louisville and purchased Anything Grows in the late 1990s. What was the appeal of interior plants?
Well, it wasn't necessarily so much the appeal of interior plants. Uh-huh. The business I was involved with previously, I had a number of partners and was really ready to go out and do something on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And this was an opportunity that came across my desk. Plants are something that make people very happy.
Mm-hmm.
They're certainly very good for the environment. And I saw an opportunity for growth.
Great. No pun intended, right?
Did you have a background in plants prior to this, or decorating or anything of that kind of stuff?
No, I was a Chapter 11 attorney.
Okay.
Well, that old story,
that's
huh?
That's reacting against the man.
what a wonderful upward climb that is.
I think it is.
I was recently retained by General Motors in connection. No, just kidding.
Jeez.
So good career change,
is that
I
your
think.
Private jet parked outside here, by the way?
All right. Craig, you know, we're kind of in the middle of the so-called green movement. Have you noticed an influence on what you do, what your customers want, because people are more interested in being green somehow?
I think I'm probably a little bit more in tune to it than a lot of our customers are.
Uh-huh.
So we're trying to educate our customers on the benefits not only of plants, but also the kinds of containers that we're using that are more carbon neutral in terms of how they're being made and less volatile organic compounds. And that has resonated with a number of companies lately.
Okay. So just sort of those things that would go unnoticed mostly and the ripple effect of the production.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Less electricity in the manufacturing process and then what the containers are actually made out of, more bamboo, more reusable products.
Okay. Wow.
Well, let's talk about the services you do provide, kind of a broad look at what Anything Grows does from A to Z.
I guess very simply, we design, we sell, and we maintain live tropical plants for commercial as well as residential interiors.
Mm-hmm. Are they predominantly really large?
No, not necessarily at all. It could be something that sits on top of a tabletop, or it could be something that sits... inside a three-story atrium of an office building that may be 40 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
And everything in between.
So take us through the process. You get a call, I've got a three-story building, I need plants. What do you do? How do you handle it?
Normally what we like to do is go down and meet with the client in their space, take a look at what their space looks like. They may have some idea what they would like to see there, maybe not necessarily a particular variety of plant, but something tall, something short, something full, something narrow or columnar. We like to receive their input. And then, as you were talking about before, taking into account the design of the space, what's on the floor, what's on the walls, and then, of course, what kind of light is available, where furniture is, It may not even be there yet where it's going to eventually be placed. We get involved in obviously looking at plans and blueprints. And if we're very fortunate early on, we're working with the architect as well, who may have us in mind for particular spaces in addition.
Is there any thought of coordinating the exterior and interior landscaping to kind of a fluid, or do you care?
Well, we care, but not necessarily.
Right.
I mean, if something's heavy outside of a window, we may not be so heavy on the other side of that window, because if you're sitting in a room like I'm sitting in now and looking at a window and seeing the other side, if I'm already getting the benefit of what's green on the other side, I may not necessarily put it on this side of the space as well.
So if you do have the benefit of working with an architect from the ground up, so to speak, does that sometimes allow you to have like built-in containers for some of the plants that you may choose to use, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. I mean, I guess a perfect example would be the Brown and Williamson Tower. You've got all those built-in beds right there. And that's something that was planned on the front end as opposed to something that was added after the fact, which is the case when you put containers in a space as opposed to something that's got built in and you have to fill it up with dirt and gravel and provide a drainage bed, et cetera, et cetera.
So, Craig, what are the tools of the trade, you know?
The tools of the trade for me are my eyes, my ears listening to the client, knowing the material, the plants itself, and then, of course, the containers. And a tool that I use to kind of bring all of that together is I'll show the client what their space looks like presently, and then I'll show them what it looks like afterwards using digital photography and then software, which allows me to drop the plants and the containers into the space.
So in terms of the folks that work with you and for you, that are more the maintenance teams that go out and take care of the plants once they've been installed, what are their tools? I mean, is it essentially just a watering can going around and watering plants, or do they have moisture monitors? Do they, you know, what do they need?
What they have is... some of our listeners may already be familiar with it. They may have seen our technicians out there, or one of our competitors' technicians out there. They have a large tank. Many of them have a large tank that they are simply pushing or pulling.
Okay.
It's on wheels.
Okay, they're, so not
it's
a backpack.
Not on their back. It's not like Rocket Man.
Okay.
Many of our listeners know, too. And we have researched that and thought about doing that as well, but have chosen not to.
Okay.
That watering tank allows them to hold a great amount of water.
So they don't have to go back and fill up the watering can over and over again in the bathroom.
Exactly right. Now, the other tools are, they've 2-gallon buckets, and there are some places where you just can't bring in a watering machine. They, of course, have scissors, they have dusters, they have pruners. You mentioned a soil monitor or reader, which is a probe that goes down into the soil and can measure where the soil is moist, if it's moist at the bottom, if it's moist up at the top. And sometimes just because it's moist at the top doesn't mean it's moist at the bottom. There could be an air pocket. And if that's the case, then the plants aren't taking up the water and the nutrients that they need from their roots, which is, of course, at the bottom.
So I guess, too, it would be extremely important to have the right kind of containers for the plants in terms of drainage and not sitting in water, you know, because some containers don't have drainage holes in them, you know, if people are trying to do themselves, and you may run into problems.
Right. 95% of what we do, the plants are in a nursery container or a grow pot, and then they're dropped down and placed inside a decorative container.
Okay.
And as you mentioned, many times our plants do sit in water for a period of time as we're going from week to week, or if it's an every other week schedule. The most important thing is, as long as they've got air, the plants have air that can circulate, that the roots can get air, they will do just fine.
Okay. Now, do you rent plants, or customers buy plants, or some combination thereof?
It's both. We can do a rental program where no different than renting or leasing a car, so they don't have to put a large amount of money up front. And then, of course, we provide a maintenance program, or they can go ahead and purchase the plants up front, and then we provide a maintenance program as well. It's going to be cheaper the latter way, but some companies, they'd rather not tie their money up on the front end and try to have to figure out what to do with it to capitalize it, or just simply write it off as an expense.
Okay, so let's talk about the biggest job you've got in Louisville, and feel free to name names. I'm curious, how many plants, what the process is. Is it a seven-story building or what?
Well, I mean, we have a number of clients in town where we do 12 to 13 or 14 floors of an office building.
How many plants might be in that kind of situation?
You know what? I can't even begin to guess.
Okay.
I'll be honest with you. But it's in the Aegon Tower. It's in the National City Tower. I mean, those are two clients of ours and multiple floors. And, of course, Brown & Williamson was the same before they relocated down to Winston-Salem.
So is that like is one person there just constantly going through the floors? Or do you go in and one day get it all done?
Well, I mean, our job, our technician's job, and subsequently it's my job and our management team, is to have our horticulturists as efficient as possible. The least amount of windshield time, the better off everybody's going to be.
To
so we really want to pack our roots and make them very dense. And in answer to your question, we have somebody that spends probably 3 days down in the Aegon Tower between all the clients that we do in that building.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, do you rotate plants if they look a little sick? You haul them out and put something new in?
The way that our contractor, our program works is it's guaranteed horticultural service, which means they're paying us a flat fee each month to take care of their plants, to manage their inventory. Anything goes wrong with the plants, either aesthetically because maybe they've outgrown their space, they're too old, they're too sick, they've come down with a disease, we go ahead and change out that plant at no additional cost at that time. It's sort of a capitalized program, kind of like healthcare, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's challenging to grow tropical plants indoors where there's, you know, low relative humidity, that sort of thing. How do you guys sort of offset that? I mean, and, you know, how do you keep everything looking so fresh?
If you really think about it, it is very challenging because these plants grow in the tropics, they grow in the subtropics. Just a real short story. When I first got into this business in 1999, a year later, I went to the largest tropical plant industry exhibition show, which is held every year down in Fort Lauderdale. And I took a tour of a number of the nurseries that we work with, and I saw plants to me that were almost unrecognizable. Mm-hmm. But they were, in fact, the very plants that we take care of every day, because I saw them out there in their natural environment.
And they're humongous
big,
and lush.
Big, giant leaves as opposed to little teeny ones that we see.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a great deal of training and knowledge. It's not just as simple as splashing and dashing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our horticulturalists spend one-on-one with one of our senior people anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks before they go out there on their own. Every single day, you know, learning how to take care of the plants, diagnose the issues, treat the plants as the case may be, and they receive extensive education.
Mm-hmm.
We also encourage continuing education. Just like I have my certification, we encourage and pay for our horticulturalists to get that certification as well.
So are there any tricks of the trade that people can sort of translate into their own homes and making their plants look as good as your plants out in the lobby?
the tricks of the trade really are you need to use your fingers to touch the soil and see what's going on.
Some
people just don't like to get their hands dirty, but this is a business where you really need to get your hands dirty. Mm-hmm. I mean, our horticultural technicians, their fingernails are always dirty. Always.
So, Craig, do you guys have a greenhouse where you have lots of backup plants?
Infernary.
we had what I would call a traditional greenhouse, although we don't propagate anything. Everything we bring, everything we have at our facility, which now is a warehouse, where we can control the light levels very well, and we've got skylights as well. Everything comes up from South Florida
via
truck.
That may actually be better because then it kind of gets to adjust or acclimate to the realities of lobby life.
that is an excellent
point. From warehouse
point.
To lobby.
It is. I mean, they're coming from sunny South Florida.
Yeah.
Although the growers that we work with, they are interior growers anyway, exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got shade cloth that helps that acclimation process to begin with. Then, of course, it comes into our facility where it's, you know, we want to maintain that lower light level before it gets out to the client's location. Because what we don't want to happen is for the plants to go into shock and to start shedding.
Yeah.
And you may be familiar with a ficus tree or a fig tree, right. And you know, you can move those 6 inches and they'll start shedding.
Yeah.
They're just
very
finicky that way.
Yes.
Very sensitive.
Just like
trees.
You, Bob.
That's true. Well, maybe 3 inches and I'm already shedding. How about some other, for lack of a better term, bulletproof plants that people might try? Listeners of the show say, okay, what can I grow that I can't possibly screw up that looks pretty good most of the time?
You know, I tell you, a plant a lot of people are very familiar with that's pretty easy to take care of is a peace lily or a spathiphyllum, as the case may be. And the nice thing about that plant is it lets you know when it needs water. Mm-hmm. It kind of droops a little bit, yeah, and lays over. And the nice part about that is it will come back. Mm-hmm. If you give it water, it will come back. The tip I have there is you shouldn't water your plants with ice cold water. If you could water them with room temperature or even sort of tepid/warm water, your plants will be a lot happier.
Because I've been to Christmas parties where some ice cubes got dumped in plants, yeah, once in a while.
but that's actually an interesting tip that somebody had shared with us. Putting ice cubes on top of the soil so you sort of self-water or sub-irrigate the plants is actually a pretty interesting trick.
The bourbon helped too? Or?
Yeah. So, yeah, that begs the question, Bob. What are some of the weirdest things that you've found in some of the containers you take care of? And, you know, are people inclined one way or the other to be somewhat abusive to plants in public spaces?
Well, or, you know,
not necessarily public.
We're sort of conscious about the places that we locate our mm-hmm. plants and the kind of people that we do business with. Yeah. So we don't want to put our plants in harm's way, so to speak.
And people can't smoke inside anymore, so there's not many
That's
cigarette
right.
butts.
Although there's no question about it, when that was the case, the plants became cigarette containers and trash containers. Mm-hmm. But you know, we do hospitals in town, and we've found a lot of interesting things in there.
I can only imagine.
All right.
Little fingers and stuff.
No,
not
no,
quite
no.
that bad.
No.
Okay.
Very interesting. Anything new that you all think you might be getting into?
Well, the big push that we're going to be getting into for 2009 are going to be green roofs.
Okay, I was wondering about that.
That's a big push that's been going on. Well, first of all, it's been going on in Europe and internationally for years. Mm-hmm. And it's finally getting to the point where places domestically here in the United States are doing things as well. There's some very obvious benefits in addition to, you know, making an otherwise gravel, black, unattractive roof actually look very nice and very inviting.
Like you
particularly
said.
If it's a hotel and the other side of it is the pool area. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you can walk out onto this rooftop garden. It's certainly becoming very popular as well in the healthcare world, mm-hmm. in the hospital world and other type institutional facilities.
Thank you, Craig.
We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. Craig Lustig owns and operates Anything Grows, where they specialize in taking care of interior landscapes for Louisville businesses. For more information on interior landscape and Anything Grows, please visit our website at wfpl.org.
After the break, that lucky Janine gets to visit the gardens of Biltmore Estate, Nashville, North Carolina. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Janine Wishian. I'm in Asheville, North Carolina, here at the famed Biltmore Estate, America's largest privately owned home. We're going to find out a little more detail about that as well. But of course, primarily, I'm here to talk with the horticulture team and check out the gardens. Biltmore Estate is, in fact, in, as I said, Asheville, North Carolina. It's where George Washington Vanderbilt fell in love with the mountains and built his home here. He opened it up to his friends on Christmas Eve in 1895, so I think it's very appropriate for us to be here this time of the year. The home boasts 250 rooms. Today, there are about 8,000 acres around the estate, which includes natural woods, agricultural lands, parkland, and formal gardens. I'm here with Parker Andes. He is the Biltmore's Director of Horticulture. Parker, you've been here for 8 years, sort of overseeing everything, you know, something that's taken many, many years to accomplish. But thank you so much for walking us around and welcoming us to the Biltmore.
Well, we're happy you're here. Being from Louisville, you've got this history with Frederick Law Olmsted, the same as we do here with the estate.
Yeah. So we'll talk about that for sure, because Olmsted and his son were part of the primary designers of the overall garden scheme, if you will, of Biltmore. But first, let's talk about, I guess, the inception of the estate, the land, the gardens, when George Washington Vanderbilt first came to North Carolina.
George Washington Vanderbilt purchased some land in this area. You fell in love with the views, especially at the site where Biltmore is right now. And after he had bought some land, like most very intelligent people, he thought, well, I better get some other intelligent people to help me on this project. And he called Frederick Law Olmsted, who had done some work with the Vanderbilt family in New York in the past, and basically asked him, well, what have I done and what should I do with it? Olmsted gave him some very specific suggestions, actually spent several months researching the land, and he said that a gentleman of your stature would take such a land and make a small parkland around his house, and then the rest of the property would, I'll paraphrase it, invest in forestry and create a wonderful managed forest property, much like they were doing in Europe, but at the time was not being done in the United States.
So when Vanderbilt got here and when Olmsted got here, what in fact did they see? You know, what was it that they had to work with?
Well, they saw these beautiful views on the distance. When they looked closer, what they saw was a lot of basically over-timbered forest land, some worn-out farmland. A lot of this is very steeply sloped, and at that time, people would be able to work up on the hillsides. Well, the soil erosion just came right down. So they started with a palette that most of us would look at and go, I'm not so sure this is a great idea. In fact, Olmsted referred to George Vanderbilt, told George Vanderbilt that some of the land was just not worth it. So,
and it's interesting too, because when you're here today, it seems like, well, I mean, and it was a long time ago, but the 1880s, 1890s, you know, and beyond, of course, but it has so much age to it. And there's all these fabulous, you know, Nordman fir that are just bigger than I have seen in a long time, Norway spruce, all kinds of evergreens that really anchor, I guess, this design motif for what was supposed to be that parkland or that periphery of the former gardens and the estate. Can you talk about the evolution of that design from the house outwards?
Sure. Near the house, Olmsted referred to the areas as the home grounds. And the home grounds were basically a small pleasure park, a small garden, small in that day, you know, we're close to some 100 plus acres, but 60 some acres of very manicured gardens. And then from that nugget around the house to the west and to the south is a deer park, the English Deer Park, that you look out from the west side of the house, and you have this wonderful vista, open fields and these oak trees, and I'll use the quote, singularly and in groups, which is how they were instructed to plant them. So, which is what we do today. We still follow those same design intents. And then beyond that, this wonderful vista of patchwork farmland, but mostly forested land, and then right on up to Mount Pisgah and then to the Great Smokies beyond.
So what's interesting too, the house is a French chateau style house. And again, this drive, and I've heard people talk about it before, the approach, is that what it's called?
The approach road, and that's what it's been called all along. It kind of dropped back into that 1895 thinking, and you would arrive on a railroad car, and you would be met with a horse and carriage. And at that point, you had 3.5 miles before you got to the house. So if you're in a horse, 3.5 miles, you might be, if you were moving right along, you know, somewhere around 3 to 4 miles an hour. So you would be on this gentleman's estate for almost an hour before you ever saw the house, riding on this gentleman's estate up this approach road, which set the stage. And we still talk about it today in the same terms that Olmsted and Vanderbilt talked about it. What would the guest see? What would the guest feel? It was very choreographed. And so we have these wonderful drawings for the approach road. Some of them are 12 feet long, and they just show portions of it. And so it was a very highly landscaped, very technically landscaped roadside. Lots of course, native rhododendrons and native kalmias, mountain laurels and dog hobble, all those wonderful plants that they collected so much of and moved there, but also a lot of ornamental plants. So you'll see bamboos, and you'll see at that time there were akuba and some other plants that just haven't proved hardy over the years, to give it a subtropical luxuriance. What Olmsted asked for was he wanted the guests to feel closer to the sun. So in coming from New York, that they would come down, they would feel closer to the sun. Of course, they had the healthy mountain air, beautiful vistas. But it was that emotion of being, I'm no longer in New York. I am in the South. I'm in the South now. And the plants were to be just part of this experience that they would have. There were carriage roads. There are carriage roads still. Obviously, the garden paths were designed for a guest to visit and take strolls in the garden. So it was also choreographed to think about it that way. If you come to the front of the house, you've come up this approach road, this 3-mile approach road through what would feel a natural valley following a stream course up, and you break open onto this French chateau with this very French landscape on the east side of the house. When you go through the house, you come to the west side and you look out over this English deer park. And Olmsted was a true magician with that. He wonderful design on that, where you didn't experience incongruent landscapes, but you experienced one, then you would go through a transition and boom, you'd see a different one. So it's wonderful.
The use of the garden rooms and the anticipation concept again, too.
Yes, we just have very, very large garden rooms. So as you visit the what we call the Italian garden, which is they call the terrace garden at the time, these wonderful water lily displays. Well, we have 10,000 plus square foot of water lily displays. So you need to come back in June, July, and August and see these wonderful, exuberant displays of lotus and water lilies, all kinds of aquatic plants. So a guest would see that and actually play croquet at that point. Well, you go below the hedge into this other terrace. There's a shrub garden. The very height of fashion in the late 1800s, early 1900s, the latest landscape design techniques of these wonderful shrub gardens with paths that guests would wander through and walk through. And it was laid out just for that. You would go from that garden to the spring garden, from the spring garden to the glen, and you could experience the walled English wall garden, of course, with a conservatory sort of set here in the middle of it all to anchor it.
I think a lot of people don't realize the legacy of timber management that the Biltmore has. Can you talk a little bit about, you talked about the original design of, maintaining and managing good timber, kind of natural wilderness, but then also using it as a resource. So talk about the forestry school. Talk about the legacy there and how you guys, are still trying to support timber management.
Well, obviously, our mission is the preservation of this estate. And when you look at what is this estate, the very first part of that was this timbering, this forestry program to reforest the hillsides, to reforest everything that George Vanderbilt was seeing from his estate. And as he traveled to the estate, even before he moved in, they had planted some 300-plus acres of white pines, lots of focus on that. And at that point, there was not a large scientifically managed forest in the United States. There were, of course, in Europe. So Olmsted worked with George Vanderbilt, and Guilford Pinchot was, in fact, the first forester at the Biltmore Estate. Now, he later went on to become the head of the U.S. Forest Service when that developed. After him, Carl Schenck came in, and Carl Schenck really took Pinchot's forest management plan and really pushed it. And at that point, the estate grew to over 120,000 acres, all the way up into what we call the Pisgah National Forest now. And Schenck instituted a school of forestry, and it was the very first school of forestry in the United States.
And is that still around?
The school itself is not around, but if you go up and visit the Pisgah National Forest up near Brevard, just on what used to be a state property, there's the Cradle of Forestry, the National Forest Service, wonderful little area of interpretation and education on the history of forestry in the United States.
It's pretty impressive, I think.
It's a wonderful place to visit, too, and to know that it was part of the estate. In 1915, at that point, George Vanderbilt had passed away, but his wife, Edith, his widow, actually sold 80,000 acres of built more land to what would become at that time would become the National Forest Service, with the caveat that it was to be used as national forest and was to be used for the enjoyment of all the United States citizens. So she really, it was one of those conservation easements that's still hanging around today.
Great, good idea. Okay, so today the estate is 8,000 acres. How much of it are you in charge of?
Well, I do have the wonderful job of being responsible for the forestry program, and we have a pretty active forestry program where we will be on basically a 20-year cycle going into each of the areas on every 20 years. And we do harvest timber. We have a lot of these white pines that are here, thanks to George Vanderbilt and Mr. Olmsted. And those have actually, some of those areas have been harvested two and three times now. So it's a very productive, very, very productive forest. So I have that area. We also take care of all the roads on the estate. We take care of the drainage on the estate. Obviously, the gardens. We have a great arborist group that does some of the most wonderful work. We do lots of lightning protection, and we have some big old trees, and we try and maintain and preserve those big old trees. The garden managers do a wonderful job with this historic preservation, and also things like the new inn on the property and the Lion Crest, which is a restored barn, which we use as a convention center. Some of the nicest landscapes that you'll see around, I think.
Okay, Parker, when we were walking about the gardens, you resisted the notion or the language of plant collections. And you were like, no, we don't really have collections as such because it's a gardener's garden. So there's lots of plants everywhere, surely, but it's a different sort of philosophy, I think.
It is. Think about it. Again, drop back to that Vanderbilt era where you were displaying plants. And that was the whole point, was to display plants to evoke emotion. So we don't do collections. Yes, we have an orchid house, but we don't really do collections. What we do is display plants, and we continue to display the some of the newest, nicest, greatest plants that we can find.
Are there any particular individual plant specimens that the Biltmore's extremely proud of?
Well, obviously with a 100-year-old garden, we have a number of plants that are out on the market. Snowbird azalea is one that was collected here on the estate. And there's a couple of other ones that people can find. We also have a line of branded plants where we work with nurserymen to create and market a line of Biltmore brand plants. And these are the plants that have some connection to the estate that gardeners around the United States can purchase those. When you go through the gardens here, you will see, 100-year-old trees, and some of the larger, we have a number of national champion trees and a lot of state champion trees here on the estate. And that gives us those bones of the gardens. We were talking about, what the garden looks like in December it's really gorgeous. You know, you won't see all the flowers, but it really is attractive, and you get to see how the landforms work a little bit better and how those trees fit into it. For me, it's those big trees. When someone is on the loggia looking out over the deer park and they see these big, huge white oaks and red oaks and hickories all throughout this deer park, that sense of openness and that sense of a landscape that you feel it. When you look at it, you really feel it. You get that from the larger trees. If it was newly planted, what George Vanderbilt saw, he really never got it as much as we get it. So we're very thankful to him.
And it's something that Frederick Law Olmsted is so very good at, isn't he? And we're benefiting from those forward-thinking ideas.
Yeah, he talked about in a number of his landscapes, including maybe even at Louisville, but I know in Central Park and here and a number of other, that he was never going to see the fruits of his labor, that it would be generations would appreciate the work that they did then. So.
Thank you so much, Parker, for your time. We really do appreciate it. I intend on coming back other times of the year to be sure so I can enjoy it. But literally, I think you are right. Coming in December, you can enjoy the holiday sort of festivities for sure. But those old, the evergreens, I think you could potentially miss that majestic legacy there in those trees if there was too much else going on. So it's a good time of the year to be at the Biltmore. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And come back anytime. But yeah, it's a good time of the year to visit.
All right. Thanks a lot. Parker Andes is the Biltmore's Director of Horticulture. He's been here for 8 years. Prior to that, you were at Callaway Gardens in Georgia. Yes. If you want more information on the gardens here at Biltmore, you can visit our website at WFPL.org, of course, and take a look at some of the pictures that we've taken as well of our visit here with Parker. Coming up next, we've got a new plant story and a holiday quiz by Bob. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I remain Bob Hill with a goofy holiday food and plant quiz for Miss Wishy.
So no questions today. Rather some embarrassment for me.
I lived to embarrass you.
Okay. That's all right.
We haven't done a quiz in a while.
And I'm pretty easy to embarrass, I don't care so much, do I?
And just because I love you so much, I've actually, at the first two questions involving food.
Oh, thanks.
Of which I know nothing.
And which I know.
More than I do.
Yeah.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Here we go. First one's a little easy because I want to get you started on a confident note.
Okay.
A lot of these questions were kind of involve famous people and their recipes.
Okay.
So, Mrs. Woodrow Wilson's holiday clam dip recipe was first written down in longhand with a Ticonderoga pencil by Mamie Eisenhower, a chef at the League of Nations, Mrs. Woodrow Wilson, Jackie Kennedy, or Rachel Ray?
Mrs. Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, you did it.
God, that's like so easy it scares you. It's okay. Who's buried in Grant's tomb?
Actually, I've got the recipe if you'd like to know.
Okay.
It's a small can of clams,
uh-huh.
8 ounce package of green cheese, 2 to 4 tablespoons of grated onion and salt and pepper. What the heck kind of food is that?
Really?
Okay.
Okay.
We'll toughen up a little bit here now. Martha Washington's olives of beef with sweet and sour sauce was a great favorite with George because he didn't like to eat anything with a name like Beef Wellington. There were a lot of cattle and olive trees at Mount Vernon. Martha didn't like to cook, and this left a lot of leftovers. George had bad teeth, and this recipe didn't involve much cooking or chewing. It was a recipe given him by Thomas Jefferson. Wrong.
Lots of olives and beef?
Nope. He had bad teeth.
Well, I know that.
And he couldn't chew much.
Oh.
So that's why she made it for him.
Hmm.
Wasn't she thoughtful?
But olives and beef still hard to chew. Would she put it?
I'm going by what the book said.
Huh.
1 for 2. In Holland, the feast of Sinterklaas, or St. Nicholas, is always celebrated, 1, in wooden shoes, 2, on December 21st, 3, by decorating windmills with brightly painted wooden shoes, 4, underwater, 5, on December 6th.
Oh.
That's a tough one.
Maybe the 21st.
But December 6th.
Oh. Sorry. Well, at least I picked the right genre.
1 out of 3, America. There we go.
These are hard.
Well, in Italy and Sweden, St. Lucia's Day is annually celebrated with the Festival of Lights, at which, 1, the youngest daughter dons a crown of burning candles and wakes the family with coffee and buns. 2, volunteer fire departments are on high alert. 3, the center of every town is lit with candles and lights. 4, service at the local churches is by candlelight. 5, a Charlie Brown character named St. Lucy pulls the soccer ball away from Charlie just as he kicks it.
Wait, what country are we?
Italy and Sweden.
Italy and Sweden. So and I do know this because Santa Lucia, I mean, you have flaming candles in your hair and you wake up everybody with coffee.
It's amazing, isn't it?
I do know that.
Well,
it's because my people are Swedish.
Okay.
So.
Have you ever done that as a kid?
I can't say that we have, but we do have like the candles that are like that, but we weren't really allowed to light them and put them on our head.
You do wonder if the volunteer fire departments are on alert.
Knew my Swedish people would come through for me eventually.
2 out of 4. The word mistletoe is derived from the old Anglo-Saxon custom of newlyweds wearing holly on their feet as a scratchy honeymoon fertility rite, a bird called the mistle thrush often fed on it, the old Saxon word mistletang, which meant a different kind of twig. The fact it often has five leaves at every node or last, it was the first remedy for athlete's foot.
Hmm. I'm going to have to say mistletang.
Doggone it. You got that one right, too.
Ha!
It was also, there was a bird called mistle thrush.
Yeah, that was my, yeah.
Boy, so you got three out of five. Here's the,
okay,
here's
so
the one
so
to get
bad.
You in next grade. You may graduate on this one. According to Pliny the Elder, one of my favorites, holly flowers had the ability to, one, lure bees to its honey hives, two, turn water to ice, three, turn mint juleps into something actually worth drinking, four, cure gout, intestinal flu, and the heartbreak of psoriasis, five, make excellent perfume, or six, restore lost virginity.
I'm going to go with lure bees to the hive.
That's
honeys.
Too simple. Turn water to ice.
Oh.
Pliny the Elder.
Pliny.
He knew his bees. He knew his water.
He must have been
ice.
Drinking that night.
Mint juleps. Well, that's it, kid. I think
All
you
right.
got some right and
I
some
got
wrong.
Three. Did I get two right or three right?
I think you got three out of six.
Okay, so that's not so bad.
You're,
50%.
We'll keep you around another year.
All right, thanks. All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us?
The arbor vitae.
Aha. Uh-huh. There's got to be some interesting information
it's
a
amazing.
Word like that.
Yet another one I didn't realize, and it's kind of confused at times with the eastern red cedar or the juniper.
Uh-huh.
Grows along the highway, and people sometimes right. think that's arbor vitae. It's not, but they're both called cedar, so there is some competition
that's
there.
The trickiness about
yeah.
common names.
Exactly. And the arbor vitae is, as the cedar, it's kind of soft and resistant to rot at the same time. It's a neat tree.
Mm-hmm.
It does really well, basically, in wet, swampy areas.
Huh.
Thoreau said it was both mossy and moosey. I love that.
That is cool.
Thoreau.
It's descriptive.
Yeah, it's mostly north of here and in the mountains east of here, but it's
where it's native to,
yeah.
you mean?
But yeah. we have a very common different cultivars in our yards. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
we'll talk about that in a minute. The name is very deceptively simple, but with a story. Arbor is Latin for tree.
Mm-hmm.
Vitae is for life.
Of course.
It's the tree of life.
Awesome.
Story behind it. It's the first tree that ever went from North America back to Europe.
Oh.
It was taken back home. The reason why. In 1535, a French explorer named Jacques Cartier,
mm-hmm.
family was jewelers, I think, was exploring the St. Lawrence River looking for the Northwest Passage,
right.
weren't they all, had to spend the winter in a fort. The whole crew got scurvy. A local Native American came up and said, hey, take the bark off the arbor vitae, the leaves. They did.
Yeah.
You know what's in there?
Vitamin C.
You got it. So he took the concoction back to France, and mm-hmm. King Francis I named it arbor vitae, the tree of life.
Ah.
Because it saved the guys
the people on
from
the
scurvy.
Yeah.
Huh. I never put it together.
Expedition. Very good.
That arbor vitae was the northern white cedar, the Latin for that, Thuja occidentalis. Greek Thuja is perfume. Occidentalis, this is cool. It means sunset or from the west.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a perfume tree from the west, at least the west of France.
Right, yeah.
And the other one in our country is the Thuja plicata, which is a much larger tree, the giant western red cedar.
Uh-huh.
I've got those.
Uh-huh.
And plicata means, I didn't know this, to fold or overlap.
Uh-huh.
So the Thuja plicata has folding, overlapping foliage.
And it does,
yeah.
when you say that.
The giant western
mm-hmm.
cedar. It's used a lot in locally in our gardens. I've got several of these myself. A lot of the cultivars, like De Groot Spire,
mm-hmm.
kind of a twisty arborvitae to 20 feet. Emerald Green is a common hedge. You mm-hmm. see it all the time. Technie is a common hedge. Then there's the Golden Globe or Globosa. Obviously, it grows mm-hmm. in a globe shape. And the golden one is a golden one. So it's pretty common in our...
Spring
in our
Grove also is a very
yeah,
nice one from
yeah.
our Spring Grove Cemetery.
And
in
if
Cincinnati.
You have space, and I've got several large arborvitae mm-hmm. hedges, and I just love them, and I like mm-hmm. The needles are cool. Comes with a poem, of course.
Of course.
Consider how great our history when bark is peeled from a common tree by native hands of some mystery, and the final result is vitamin C. Taken back home by a French Captain Gruff, who showed his king this magical stuff, who waved his wand all sorcerers to see, and thus was born the arbor vitae. The first of our trees to be shipped to the east, the first of many into the maw of that beast, The source of our wars, our stress and our strife, yet also, it must be said, our tree of new life.
Very nice. The arborvitae.
Tree of life.
So yeah, this time of the year, if you can't get a hold of any citrus, just chew on the bark of
arborvitae. And you'll have vitamin C there and no scurvy in your house.
There we go. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Lee Peterson and the Peterson Field Guide to Birds of America, of North America.
Or South.
Mostly north.
Okay. Homegrown is produced by our Happy New Year host, Brad Yost, in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishey. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.